Welcome to CFO Talk. I'm your host, Steve Rosewald, Chief Learning Officer at CFO.University. Joining us today is Lynn Sheehan, founder and CEO of Evolve Strategic Ventures, a business transformation firm based out of Vancouver, Washington. Lynn has a degree in laser and optical engineering. He spent 8 years at the Fusion Program in Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. Before starting Evolve in 2017, he worked for a number of well-known and successful tech companies. I'm excited to share Lynn's message, Crossing the Chasm in Times of Chaos, with our member scholars. Welcome, Lynn. It's great to have you on our show.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate the introduction. So it's nice to meet everybody who's going to be watching this. I look forward to interacting with this organization more and more. I've seen some great things already out at CFO University.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And I've loved our interactions. We met just a few months ago at Washington State University in a mentor program they have. And I really enjoy what you're doing with your clients and how you're transforming business today. We're going to jump right in and talk about you and kind of how you've evolved from an engineer and an R&D director into business strategist, then leading companies, and now running your own company. But first, let's go back to where you transformed from the research and development director at HP in Dublin to become the business strategist. And I found that story really compelling, how that came about and why they chose you for that really important role of business strategist.
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, during my early part of my career, as you said, I was very focused on research and development. And this was everything from very fundamental cutting edge research to solving problems in real time on projects. But the majority of those were projects that might take 3 to 5 years. Some of the longest were up to a decade. And so when you're working on fundamental research where your project schedule and your focus has to be maintained over years and years, I think one of the things you learn in that environment is how do you really stay to a long-term strategy and a vision. And so, you know, I think that early learning that I had on how do you stay on track for those periods of time actually eventually dovetailed very well into how do you take that same type of strategy of sticking to a vision over a longer term and planning for a longer term outcome in a business environment. And some of the things just personally, I always love to learn. And I think that people that I've worked with and people that have mentored me have always seen that I love to learn. And so when the opportunity comes up to help an organization, you know, the fact that I always show passion and I'm always willing to learn something new, and I've been lucky enough to be pulled into some of those changes. And one of those was going from doing research and development into managing large corporate businesses.
Well, would you say that's one of the main criteria that HP used when you made that? Because taking an engineer who's running an R&D department might not be the first choice for people to bridge that commercial gap and help and become a business strategist. They're not antithetical, but they're not necessarily congruent either. So what were the characteristics that HP saw in you where they said, hey, we'd like you to take on this business strategy role?
Well, I think part of it is just that passion to do things well. You know, in the research environment, you know, it's a very structured environment of how you attack a problem. And I think in business, and I'm sure a lot of your audience can attest to, sometimes businesses are not run with that passion to do things well. They want to do things quickly, but sometimes not always with the diligence. And so I think part of it was just that I have a passion to do things well. And the other, as I said, is I'm willing to put my name into the hat to take on a role if it's really going to help the business. And what made the transition at HP was that I was complaining quite a bit to my executive team about the funding for research and development. And they were trying to explain to me that they can only invest a certain amount of their business income into research. And my side of things was, well, but if you don't invest in the research, then where's the future of the company? And so you get into this catch-22. And so through those discussions, I was invited to join the business team. And part of that was to allow me to learn more about how the business actually operates so that then maybe we could find an optimal place where I can understand where the funding comes from and then also provide a research program that always returns on its work.
So you were at Lawrence Livermore for 8 years, and you're in these other R&D roles that aren't necessarily, I would say, commercially focused. And all of a sudden you're being asked to be a business strategist, help the commercial team sell products or decide on what products to sell. That was a huge kind of career shift from kind of scientist and so how did you kind of, was that scary for you? How did you decide that this is the right move for me?
Was it scary? I don't think so. One thing, I was lucky to be in HP. I mean, if any of your listeners have ever worked in that company, the culture there is one of learning and support. And so, I was surrounded by people who are willing to spend the time to teach me the things that I needed to understand about making that transition. And not just, interpersonal education, but also providing me time to study books, to take courses. And so I'm, obviously very thankful for that support that I had. And, you're surrounding yourself with a team of very capable people. So as an example, I wouldn't have known really a lot about how do you design products for a customer need. And so one of our team members, that was their sole focus, was customer needs. And so I spent a lot of time just learning about things that I'd never heard of before, like customer intimacy, right? So while these were all very new topics, I was really well supported through people in the organization.
Well, that's really a great lesson for the CFOs and our finance leaders here, helping create a culture that is so supportive that you didn't it what it was I wouldn't say it was falling off a log for you, but there was no angst. I would have suspected there was a whole bunch of angst with the way that your career had gone, and all of a sudden you're moving into a different role, and they made you feel comfortable doing that. And that says a lot about the importance of building culture. And our CFO leaders and financial leaders on this video, I can learn a lot from creating that culture of acceptance and helping people feel comfortable when they're having significant career changes. One of the things you mentioned to me when we spoke earlier was that HP, Hewlett Packard, sent you to some training out in California at the CASM Institute, I think, and you've used that very effectively to build your career and your advisory practice. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So during the time I was at HP, there was a few things that were happening in the I was in specifically in the inkjet printing organization. And the inkjet printing was in decline in the market because people were not really printing as much at home anymore. They had access to photo labs that could very quickly print their photos for them. There was just other avenues to print. And so one of the things that we were looking at is how do we continue to grow the business? And, over the years I've been through obviously a lot of different classes on different ways, processes, frameworks to really drive development of any type of a solution. And, I'd say over the years I'd kind of built up a little bit of skepticism, right? I'd been told a lot of different things would solve all my problems, but they never really did. What I really liked was when I was introduced first to Geoffrey Moore's book, The Crossing the Chasm, which is now, I think, 28 or 29 years since first press. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about it is that it was easy to understand. It was also easy to take their frameworks and implement them in multiple different environments. So, for example, you could implement Crossing the Chasm in how you managed your product development, but also your research and development. And it was the first thing that I'd ever seen that kind of bridged that gap between engineering and product marketing and product go-to-market plans. And so I was lucky to spend a couple of years actually acting in that role to, within the inkjet business, really disseminate these frameworks into the different business units to help us speak a common language and to use a common tactic for how we went to market with products.
You did a really nice job with me when we had coffee on explaining what this crossing the chasm means, you know, what the metaphor that it relates to. Can you help the audience so they can maybe recognize when they've hit that wall and they need to cross the chasm? Maybe explain a little bit what you know, what it means.
Absolutely. So for those of you that are familiar with market life cycles, in a market, when you enter with a new product, there's what's called the early market. And an early market makes up only about 13% of your potential sales. And what ha often happens is that companies, especially in a startup mode or if they're launching a new product, they'll get some traction in that early market. And those early market indicators might look really great. And so they generate sales forecasts that take that early market where they were so successful and they just scale that, saying that in the future, our forecast is going to be on this rocket ship. But what happens is that once they start to saturate that early market, they hit what we call the chasm. And what this is it's a difference between the early market adopters of any type of technology and what we call the pragmatists. So the pragmatists, you know, they might be interested in what your product does, but you haven't convinced them yet that it's time to jump in. And so what happens with companies is they get stuck in this chasm, and I'll give you a real kind of technical description of how they might look at this. So there's two really key things that will happen. First is that their sales forecast will not be achieved, right? Because your sales forecasts were based on this early adoption. So if you start to see your sales falter or start to slow down, that's an indicator. That initial vendor excitement, so when your customers were initially really excited, but you stop hearing that from your customers, that means that, you know, again, those early adopters, you saturated them and they're not really as excited as they were before. And what this starts to look like is that your business deals get harder and harder to close. And so from a CFO perspective, things you can look at is if in the early phase of a product launch, they were accelerating, but then it flattens out and starts to decline or stay flat, you've definitely hit the chasm, right?
Yeah, interesting.
And so why do you hit that chasm? There's really two key things that you missed in your product. The first was what we call credible customer references. So pragmatists want to know that somebody else like them has adopted your product. So if you haven't been able to cross the chasm and get another pragmatist to adopt your product, other people will look and they'll say, "Oh, well, no one else has jumped. I'm not going to jump. Why would I be the first one?" The second thing is that you missed the mark on what's called 100% minimum viable product. And I think lots of people have heard about, you know, minimum viable product. But the way to think about that is really, did you put a product through the system that truly solves the pragmatist's pain point? Right? Because even if they're a little bit hesitant, if you're really solving a significant pain point, you can get them to adopt. So those are some of the things that might happen that cause you to hit the chasm. And then the question is, how do you get out? Because companies can stay stuck in that chasm for a long time. There are plenty of companies who are happy in that early market phase and sitting in the chasm. It's called a lifestyle business, right? You saturate your market and you just stay there and you're happy there. But if you really want to grow, you've got to cross the chasm. And so, you know, the way we really look at it is there's a couple of things you've got to do. One is when we look at those pragmatists, you need to pick one of them and consider them your beachhead. So find one of those pragmatists that you think that you can really solve that pain point for and really go after just them. Remember that they're going to be your reference for other pragmatists. The other is you have to make sure that you give them 100% of what they need as a whole product because you want them to be waving your flag, right? Because that has a knock-on effect of drawing other pragmatists into the fold. And so it's really important that you pick that product and you actually finish it. What sometimes happens is, especially in engineering companies or tech companies, is they'll get very distracted with other shiny objects. You can't do that. Stay focused on that target company, stay focused on that pragmatist, give them the solution to their pain point, cross the chasm. Once you're across, you hit what we call the bowling alley effect. You've knocked down that first pin, and now other pragmatists will start to fall. So that's kind of how you get across.
Interesting. Interesting. And from a CFO standpoint, you talked about the, 100% minimum viability. And I'm wondering, from a project standpoint, people want to start things early. They want to, maybe get something half done. Do you find where that limits the ability to really create the product? So, and I'm, what I'm trying to think of this for CFOs who are controlling these budgets, and all of a sudden somebody wants to launch something early, and yeah, we're 90% there. We want to get this out in the market a little bit. Can that be folly for some
Oh,
projects and some products?
it's actually a necessity. So doing that is perfect. You do that in that early market. You want to test and fail and test and fail and test and fail, because all of those failures are teaching you what the product really has to be. The thing you have to be careful of is to not take the success you have there and assume that it will continue to scale.
Okay.
And you also have to be careful that if you solve those problems, you failed and you learned. Did you only solve the problems for the early market adopters, or are you actually solving problems for the pragmatists? So you have to make sure that when you do your product definition, that you're defining your product with the minimum viable product targeting pragmatists, not early adopters. But certainly use the early adopters to learn, launch and learn and launch and learn, right? That's where you're doing these, alpha tests, beta tests. So that is kind of your sandbox to really test out your potential market. But you always have to really understand what is the pragmatist need.
I'm thinking what you said. So we there's KPIs or key performance indicators that might help us to determine sales targets if we're hitting the chasm. Where else do you see finance leaders participating in this to make sure that they understand what's going on, they're helping the company make good decisions? Is there places in this whole product life cycle that you've seen some really successful finance people kind of help with the process and grow the company?
Oh, for sure. I think one of the things that's really critical in this, if you just think about the story that I've just explained, something that's important in there is really defining the business model for the product and the company. And business models are not an engineer's forte, right? And business models are not necessarily a sales group's forte. But doing business models is finance's forte. And so any place that they can help to create models and tools so that engineers and product marketing people can use those tools to figure out what are the variances here I could use to take my product to market, meet that minimum viable product, but also make sure that we're maximizing profit. And that's not their normal day-to-day, but if you give them models, they will optimize, because everyone in a company wants the company to be successful. So certainly financial modeling is really critical, and I've worked in different types of organizations, some that do not support that at all, meaning that the finance group says, sorry, models are not our problem, that's your problem. And so the product marketing teams are left to figure out their own models. And when they present those models to management, nobody believes them because finance wasn't involved, right? The second version is where finance is intimately involved. And so quite often a finance group might have what we call a new product introduction finance person. And that person is really there to help as part of that NPI process of developing a product, to be the financial person, to give them those things they need. Help them with the business model, help them with modeling different types of ways you might go to market. Provide that connection to the finance team so that the CFO can be confident that at least he's got somebody who's in the room, right? That really helps. From a CFO perspective, the other piece of this that's really important is that quite often this type of a move for a company will put the company into a J curve. meaning that it's going to take quite a bit of an investment to launch whatever this new product or new market is, and that investment is going to be a negative, right? And the CFO needs to be the ones that really help figure out what can the company afford to do in that J curve, and does that match the need for the program? And because these can be quite significant shifts, right? This could be a pretty significant chunk of the company's cash. And so, the time that it takes to get through that negative J curve, with the idea that you all have to be on the same team, that when you come out of that, the goal is growth.
That's great. I love the concept, the comparison. And our industry is working. I don't know a CFO who wouldn't love to have a great financial modeler on their team. It depends upon, it's a scale thing. Smaller businesses have trouble affording that skill. Bigger companies, it's wonderful. So I don't know any CFOs who don't want to provide the modeling skills. I do know a lot of CFOs who have struggled because they with capacity is how we get a dedicated financial modeler. But it is becoming much more important. The whole FP&A or financial planning and analysis area is a huge growth area in the finance industry where modeling is becoming more important. So I think your word is getting out. The financial people are listening to you, Lynn. They see the value that they can add by partnering with the business folks and creating all those opportunities with the business folks that you're talking about. We were at a luncheon not too long ago, and you listened to this company talk. And the executives were talking about, kind of where they were at in their business. And you immediately turned and said, they're trying to cross the chasm. They've hit the wall. What things did you recognize that were so clear to you that they, this was a company that was had great potential, but it hit the chasm?
Yeah, I think there's two pieces of it. One is I'd obviously been following them as a tech company since they first relocated to Vancouver. And as a company, there was a few things that I noticed just in kind of how they were putting their product together, and it was very focused on early adopters. Meaning, and this is very common for startups, right? If somebody gives them a check to develop a product, they're gonna develop that product. The problem with that is they're going to develop that product for just that customer. So what about the next customer? What if they want it to be a different color? What if they want it to be a different platform? So instead of Android, they want it on their iPhone. What if, so you get into this problem where they haven't really looked at what the minimum viable product for the market is. What they've done is looked at what the minimum viable product is for the first adopter. And those early adopters are not great at helping you understand where the mass market is. And if you were to compare their products to some of the larger corporation products that are out there, those larger companies are really looking at a market solution, but they miss out on some of these niche solutions. And so the trick here is to have some way to navigate that and do both. And that's where the chasm frameworks really come in, because from the very early days, you're building up this idea of a whole product model. And a whole product is different than a minimum viable product. And this is where the second thing I really heard from their discussion. So, in a whole product model, you have to think about the fact that you have this core product that you sell, but you also then, on top of that might be the hardware, but what about the software? What about the peripherals? What about the headphones? What about the helmet, the hat, right? What about connectivity? What type of connectivity do you have? Is it only Bluetooth or is it 5G? And what about legacy interfaces? If somebody is actually on 4G, is it still going to work? And what are you going to do to help them understand how to use the product? What consulting services are you going to provide? That could be videos, it could be tutorials, right? All of those together create an ecosystem that is called the whole product. And this is where a lot of companies miss the boat. They might develop the hardware, but one of the things they said during that talk is we didn't realize how many people needed software, right? Or we didn't realize how many people needed to have our hardware, but they also needed another product to go with it. For example, a drone. So as he was going through the talk, he started to really discuss some of those other, what I would consider whole product pieces that they've now realized they were missing. So those were some telltale signs.
That's interesting. But I listened to you talk about that, and besides hiring Evolve Strategic Ventures to help, how do small, HP has the resources to do that. How do smaller companies obtain the resources to make sure they aren't missing some really big chunks of that minimal viable product you're talking about? How do they do that?
So I would say that there's a few different approaches. One is, so Evolve Strategic Ventures, my business, one of the things that we really help companies with is to define and then implement their strategy for growth. And when we set up the company, we very intentionally wanted to make sure we could service not just big companies, but small companies. So we actually do business programs for startups that are affordable. So that's obviously one method. The other is to go out and learn, and this is really a time thing, right? So if you go out on YouTube and search Crossing the Chasm, people like Michael Eckert, who's one of the editors of the books, Geoffrey Moore, they've been very generous to put a lot of this material on video. And so
Okay.
if reading a book is too much and you really don't get as much out of it, go watch the videos. And they have a lot of great content available. And I'm very much of the go-giver way. And so if people reach out to me, I'm more than happy to share templates and frameworks with them that are available, free from the internet that maybe they just wouldn't find. I've already found them. So I'm happy to support companies that way. And then of course, as companies are ready to make a bigger dive, we can pull the Chasm Institute into these kind of discussions, but obviously through their books, they're trying to convey those lessons. And there's really two books that I recommend to people. One is Crossing the Chasm, and then the second one is called Escape Velocity. And
Escape
escape
velocity.
velocity is really, especially in these kind of challenging times or when companies are facing a challenge in their business, the escape velocity is really about freeing your company from the pull of the past. And one thing about facing a time of crisis is you don't want to waste that crisis. And this is a good time for you to really step back and think about what are the things about our businesses that might be holding us back, or things that we've always thought about really transforming into. Now is the time. So those two books are quite useful, I think, for people to review.
Well, you'd mentioned touched on something, and then I know our time's almost up, but serving small and medium-sized businesses. You had kind of mentioned that to me a couple times. That's really important to you. So why is it important to you, and how do you execute on that?
Certainly. So I'm again blessed to have had a family history of entrepreneurship going all the way back to my grandparents and their grandparents before them. We were early settlers in America, and I remember my grandmother specifically. This would have been the early 1900s. She ran her own business, and for women to run a business then in that time would be kind of unheard of. And so I think I grew up with a little bit of that kind of spirit. And so when I look at small businesses, I really see this as our country. And I saw some great statistics out of the SBA, given what's going on in the last month about how important small businesses are in America. So the SBA statistics is that small businesses less than 500 people account for 99.7% of all businesses.
Wow.
And they employ 56.8 million people in our country. And the biggest problem then is that a large number of those companies will fail within the first 10 years of their life, and it's almost always due to cash flow. And 86% of those business owners, are people who earn less than $100,000 a year, and a lot of them, 30%, don't even take a salary. So how can we, as your audience in CFOs and finance, and my audience in business strategy, how can we help these companies by giving them some tools that they can use to create a better, more successful financial business? And so my passion is really around, let's decrease the amount of failure. Let's take advantage of what our economy is, which is small business based, but let's make it more financially viable for our country.
What a great message. What a great message. It's a great message for financial, and finance has a special place in that, I think, in helping our economies and the allocation of resources and cash flow and understanding business. And of course, the business strategy part and business transformation is so important today, because I'll tell you, there'll be a lot of us transforming our businesses over the next 6 months out of necessity. And so from that standpoint, that kind of wraps up our CFO talk. Thank you for joining us, Lynn. What a message. I mean, that was really, it was really exciting to see you have that ability to give back and willingness to share, and you're an expert in what you do. So we really appreciate that. CFO.University is a community of member scholars, companies, and trusted advisors committed to the professional development of CFOs. Visit us at www.cfo.university. Thanks again, Lynn, for joining us, and let's enjoy, learn, engage, and please be safe.
Thank you, Steve.